Welcome, inhabitants, to episode 42 of the Planet LP podcast. I'm Ted Astrogatu, and as I often say, I almost always say, this is the place where we drop the needle on a world of albums. Hey, let's follow each other on the socials, Insta and Twitter. It's the Planet LP. Facebook, just Planet LP. Email me at ted@planetlp.com. If you have a show topic, suggestions on music that I ought to be listening to, or just comment on what you're hearing on the show. Now, one piece of music that I've been listening to is a band out of Nashville, Tennessee, whose sound is quite the throwback sound to the hard rock and melodic rock sounds of the mid-70s. That band is called the Semi-Supervillains, and they're not newbies. In fact, they've just released their third album called Play That Rock and Roll, getting some airplay on radio stations around the country in the United States. Their videos are getting a lot of views on YouTube as well. The principal songwriter and lead singer from the Semi-Supervillains, Vinnie Longhi, is here for a one-on-one with me on the other side of this. Vinnie Longhi from Semi-Supervillains, how are you? Welcome to the Planet LP podcast.
Hey, Ted, how you doing today?
I'm doing all right. On my first cup of coffee of the morning. We are recording this in the morning, but of course, whenever you're listening to it is when you're listening to it. So your third album was released on January 14th, 2022, called Play That Rock and Roll. Now, as I alluded to in the introduction, this record has a real throwback sound to the mid-70s. There's more than a few bands picking up the baton of that style of music. We had the band Dirty Honey on this podcast, and their sound harkens back to the Black Crowes and Guns N' Roses, which, you know, they were 80s bands in their heyday, but they were also indebted to that 70s hard rock and sound. Now, Greta Van Fleet, their love affair with Led Zeppelin is pretty self-evident. And then there's a Semi-Supervillain. So describe your music for Planet LP listeners.
Well, Ted, if you're listening to Dirty Honey or Greta Van Fleet in this day and age, I think you'd really like our new record, Play That Rock and Roll. It's not too far off from the sound of both of those bands. We definitely keep the sound sort of our own. If you had the radio on in the 1970s, I think anything off of our new record could have been heard in between songs by Slade or the Rolling Stones on the radio. I definitely think like a lot of those bands heavily influenced by Slade, AC/DC, and then definitely going back to the Beatles. But I think that goes without saying for everyone in this day and age.
The Beatles are kind of the touchstone for a lot of bands, although Rolling Stones are there too. You know, a lot of people really look at them and say, yeah, I'm kind of more of a Rolling Stones than a Beatles person. But how about you? I mean, what are your influences? You talked about these other bands, but what were you listening to that made you sort of fall in love with this style of music?
It goes back to, you know, being like 10, 11, 12, somewhere in that time. And your dad's taking you to baseball practice and you hear AC/DC, like TNT or Thunderstruck or something like that on the radio. And you're like, Dad, what's that? And he's like, oh, that's this band called AC/DC. Let me show you more. But no, my dad was great growing up. He had a massive CD collection, and basically anything that I heard on the radio, I could dig through my dad's CD collection, and it was there. Whether it was Van Halen, Rush, you know, he had a lot of the classic rock stuff, and then a lot of the '90s stuff too. Actually, you know, so whenever I heard Nirvana for the first time, he pulled out In Utero and Smells Like Teen Spirit, and even a lot of like the early Stone Temple Pilots stuff too. He had that there. So basically, it was really cool growing up in the 2000s and being able to have access to that. Just kind of in the advent of iTunes, I would always check my dad's CD collection before I downloaded a song for 99 cents.
Exactly. Why waste the 99 cents if dad's got the CD already, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so people often deride dad rock, but you were really influenced by dad rock. It really was your dad.
Yeah, I would definitely say Play That Rock and Roll is a dad rock album. And love it or hate it, you know, it is what it is. And, you know, I kind of have to embrace it at this point. But I would say if you're a dad and you like rock and roll, you're going to like the new album.
I was looking at the comments on YouTube for your video Joyride, and there is a lot of love from people that are, well, in my age group. I'm an older Gen Xer, and I'm just like, look at this. This is great. I mean, everyone's like, thank you for this kind of music. I love it. This is great that you're doing this. And Dirty Honey had a similar response. So there seems to be this, I guess not quite a renaissance, but a reemergence of this style of rock music coming from a younger generation, you and your cohorts. And certainly you were influenced by you know, music that maybe you found on your own, but your parents, some people had older brothers or older sisters who had big music collections. So being influenced by a relative, whether it's a parent or whether it's a brother or sister or a best friend or an older cousin or something like that, that still happens, obviously, even in this day and age where streaming just gives you an unlimited amount of music, more than you could ever consume. If you had to fill a building, it would probably take up, you know, the Empire State Building if it was all CDs, if not more. So it's really hard to stand out. You're a young band, meaning that you're starting your career, even though you've been out for a while now, but you're still getting your audience and finding them and connecting with them. What are the sort of methods that you use, for lack of a better term, to get your music heard by people because of these things? Like, if everyone's on Spotify, meaning that there's tons of musicians on there and there's really no gatekeepers to it, how do you promote? How do you stand out amongst all those bands and artists?
So, Ted, the Semi-Supervillains, we've been a band for a little over 10 years now.
So you're not a new band.
No, I mean, our first record came out in 2011. I was like maybe 18 or 19 at the time. And so this is our third, our first EP came out in 2011. So during that time, you know, I grew up in the Pittsburgh area and we were pretty active in the Pittsburgh local club scene for, you know, 10 years. And, you know, we toured, we did the whole South by Southwest thing and went up through Canada and the East Coast. A lot of that stuff really is anywhere as far as, like, I think Austin and San Antonio were kind of the cutoff. We never really went further west than that. Just financially, we've had record labels. But at this point in our career, we're functioning completely independently, actually.
Excellent.
And personally, I enjoy that way more.
Yeah.
It's just a lot nicer because, you know, we can kind of call the shots and just kind of put out what we want to and not have to have anyone saying like, no, you need to do something that sounds more like this. But, you know, definitely in this time, I thought with seeing bands like Greta Van Fleet, Dirty Honey, Starcrawler, I mean, there's a whole long list of these.
Right, right.
Neoclassic rock bands that are kind of emerging. I was like, you know what, it's time for us to put this out now. So I think definitely trying to ride that wave. Earlier on in our career, we had our first album, Tricks, in 2013. And we kind of hit that tail end of the wave of like the reinvention of the garage rock. You know, bands like The Strokes and the Black Keys, The White Stripes, it was kind of on the downfall then. But still, we were able to get a lot of bookings back then regionally, you know, our tour stops and everything, just because we had a similar sound to those bands. We had good quality videos. I think definitely the videos were an important thing. You know, with the internet and social media, you kind of touched on that. It is kind of a game changer. You know, we don't have to grind 150, 200 shows a year just to try to become relevant like bands were doing in like the 70s and the 80s.
Right.
We were definitely more of like a hybrid band the entire time. And I would say even more now. So I've kind of focused a lot more of our attention on the content creation, you know, creating like albums, singles, videos, a little more than playing shows, especially in the past 2 years where you could put all this effort into booking a tour and then the next variant of pandemic disease comes out and then you have to cancel it, unfortunately.
Right,
so,
right.
You know, I think definitely our efforts, putting all that effort in the YouTube channel, I think that's been a big help. You know, I was able to grow our YouTube channel from, I think, 100 subscribers to, I think we're a little over 2,000 now in about a year and a half. So I think that's been given a new breath of life to the band and given everybody kind of some more like, all right, let's try this again. Let's see what we can do with this new record.
I think that's great. I did not know that you were a band for 10 years. And so you have done the circuit. You've probably had to play small clubs, larger venues. Maybe you opened or you had other bands that were similar in style that opened for you and you opened for them. And so you did that grind. Maybe you hit the road for 100 days or 200 days a year. I don't know. But nowadays, like you said, that the internet, because it's built out in such a way that if you produce, and for lack of a better term, and people use this term, but sometimes it bugs me when I hear it, but content.
Yeah, I know.
When you're producing this music or music video content, I guess I could say it like that. This is a way that you can connect with fans in a deeper way because there is interaction that you can do. Granted, YouTube is probably not the best place to interact with people because sometimes people can be really horrible in terms of their comments. So, and that could probably sway you in one way or another if you're one of those people that takes a compliment with a grain of salt, but somebody who's going to take a big swing at you with criticism and you'll just be like, oh, this is horrible. These people don't like me. And then you get that pile-on quality. With your song Joyride, that's getting a lot of positive reaction, which I think is wonderful. When I read through the comments, and I'm like, okay, when are the trolls going to start coming at me?
Yeah.
And I feel bad when I read that because it takes a lot in terms of commitment and money and time to put this thing together, to put an album together, to put a video together, and then to go out there and promote it. These are the things that you've been doing for 10 years and that you're said, let's try it again. Let's take another swing at it. Now, your song Joyride, which I've referenced a couple of times, when I first heard the song, and it's the first single from the album, it kind of reminded me of the first Rush album from 1974, especially the song In the Mood. You said you were influenced by that kind of rock, which has, to me, a kind of glam quality to it. Would you say Semi-Supervillains has a kind of a glam aspect? Because I hear it a little bit. It's definitely bluesy. It's very bluesy in many sections of the songs on the new album. But that song, Joyride, I'm like, I guess I'll throw out some terms, you know, boogie woogie or bluesy or glam. There's just this glam quality to it.
I'm glad that you referenced glam. I'm definitely a big fan of glam rock. In a sense, like bands like Slade, we could call Rush glam in a sense, I guess.
For a period.
Well, I mean, we're not the kind of guys that go out and dress in like sequin, you know, outfits or anything like that. But from a sound quality, I do really appreciate glam rock. Even like some of the modern bands, like the Struts, I kind of like them for a hot minute there. You know, their sound was a glam sound. You know, obviously, we don't dress like that, but you know, we're just kind of more just like your standard, just like jeans and a t-shirt kind of band.
Right, right. Yeah. You don't have a wardrobe consultant yet. So
no.
maybe you won't get one. Since you own the copyright and the masters, we can play a little bit of Joyride for our listeners so they can hear what I'm talking about. So this is Joyride from Semi-Supervillains, at least a clip of it. Sounds great. Like I said, there's that glam quality to it. Your press release that you sent out and when you sent me the CD had a lot of information about the band. Of course, you have to always introduce yourself when you're sending out press releases and highlight the thing that you're promoting, which in this case is the latest album. But one thing that stood out was this sentence, this fragment of a sentence. It says, after years of restless exploration, this feels like a definite arrival. So what was that restless part of your earlier records, I'm going to guess? When you go back and listen to your EP and the other album, do you hear a restlessness in there? Because I listened to the other two albums that you put out, at least the EP and the LP, and I didn't hear anything restless about it, but it just kind of, that phrase just sort of stood out to me.
Being the songwriter for the band, those first two records, Tricks and Here Comes Trouble, you know, I wrote those whenever I was a late teenager, early 20s. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those songs were just a lot of teenage angst and about, you know, just kind of like love and search for love and things like that. I feel like I've matured and kind of gotten past that, I guess, maybe not, but you know, I definitely feel like there was a little bit of immaturity in how I wrote some of those songs, like a little bit of extra emotional drama, especially a lot of the bands, like whenever I was in high school that were popular were a lot of those like pop punk bands and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, even though we weren't a pop punk band, just because that was just kind of like shoved down our throats during that entire period, and pop punk bands for reference, like Blink 182 and then All Time Low, those type of bands. And I don't like try to listen to them. If I do listen to it, I'm kind of embarrassed for listening to those bands anymore. But yeah, definitely. I feel like this kind of just straight up rock and roll style, I don't know. I just feel like it's just like I grew some hair on my chest or something. we're here. We're ready to rock. There's no BS. You know, we named the album Play That Rock and Roll. I think that's about as straightforward as it gets. You know, what it's going to sound like.
you're not really hiding anything, are you?
No.
Did you record this thing at home? Because you have a picture of the band in front of a house, and I take it that's your home.
Yes.
And so, did you set up a recording studio there in your house?
So the album cover, that's my house. That's all the furniture in my living room, the pink couch. I'm sitting on it right now as we do this podcast. But during the pandemic, I really kind of, you know, being in Nashville, you just kind of get consumed by everyone's attitude in a good way. Mm-hmm. And I guess some people could take it in a bad way, but you always are trying to improve your recordings and everything like that. So I really just kind of learned how to record in the past like 2 years. And yeah, we record this entire album in my house. So I figured it was most appropriate to just put all the stuff out on the lawn, you know, the amps that we use, the furniture in the living room, and just kind of arrange it in a cool way. And then we take a picture just to kind of pay tribute to the house, because the house has a good sound. I think the album has a cool sound, and some of that does come from just the room sound of recording drums in the living room and that type of thing. So
in a previous podcast episode, I had a fellow writer. We write for a site called Popdos every now and then. And we were talking about why music today does not suck, because he has his own pod. Who doesn't have a podcast, right? He has his own podcast where he poses the question in the opposite form: why today's music sucks. Now, it wasn't about necessarily the quality of the songwriting, although that did come up. He had a guest on who was another writer that I know, and they were talking about the fact that because it's so cheap to set up a recording studio, you can do it in your house, which you have done, but this technology sometimes can make things sound very sterile. One of the lines of discussion was, when you hear an album from, say, the golden years of LPs from the 60s to maybe the mid 2000s, you can hear the room. Nowadays, you don't hear the room that much anymore because of the way in which people record. They trade files with each other. They're not always in the same location when they lay down tracks. There's not one room where that sound has been set, and that's going to define the sound of the album. You're going to hear a certain quality, a characteristic. You're a musician, obviously, and you've probably heard musicians say when they go to certain recording studios, I love it. This room has such a, and they start talking about the qualities of the room because it's going to bring out something in the recording. With this album, you hear the room. So that's what I'm trying to say. Your album,
you hear
the rooms, which I think is a testament to you really trying to do a style of music from a particular time, meaning that it's like the 70s. You're also using the methods, if you will, of recording that music that musicians back then would have done, which is you're all together. You're not trading files so much. Maybe in demo form, I don't know. Maybe that's how you do it. But talk a little bit about the band members, because, you know, we've been talking to you, but there's three other guys that are in the band. And have they been with you for this whole trip?
Yes and no. So. Okay. I'll go down the line. So Johnny Panaccio, he plays bass. Johnny's been with the band since pretty much day one. Yeah, mm-hmm. You know, we played in a high school cover band together before we started this band. Originally, he was the drummer, and him and I, we kind of collaborated and wrote songs, you know, obviously with him on drums. And then about halfway through, around 2015, mm-hmm. he said, hey, I want to switch to bass. And he had only picked up the bass like 2 years prior to that. Wow. But he had just graduated college. And I think his mom and dad bought him a nice Rickenbacker bass, like a really, really good one. And I was like, all right, yeah, let's do this. So I think that was kind of like a turning point for us, because Johnny, full time became the bass player. Mm-hmm. And we still used, we kind of used kind of like a barracks of drummers during that period. But in 2019, we moved to Nashville. And when we moved to Nashville, we reunited with a longtime friend, Isaac Short. And we know Isaac probably, I've known Isaac for 10 years now, but he's from Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And we grew up kind of cutting our teeth in the Pittsburgh club scene.
Okay.
So known each other for a long time, always kept in contact. And then when I moved to Nashville, kind of like reignited that friendship, cause he had moved to Nashville, I think around 2015. But he plays in a really popular band down here called the Weird Sisters, and they're so cool. Him and his girlfriend, Gabby, they started that group together. But yeah, so Isaac, I guess it's a little side project to him, cause the Weird Sisters is his main focus by far. But he he's an engineer, or mm-hmm. I guess a home engineer just like myself. So he helped a lot with a lot of like the recording of it to just kind of make it sound cool and everything, just taking, two heads are better than one in that sense. And then Logan, the drummer, he moved to Nashville around the same time I did, around 2019. And he was hanging out with Isaac. And I think one time we were at the Groove Record Store, which is a record store here in East Nashville. And he was with Isaac and we kind of hit it off. And we just started jamming, and I liked the way he played. He liked the sound of the music. So I was like, hey, I got this project I'm working on. You want to be the drummer for it? And he was like, yeah. So he played drums on it. So,
all right. Logan yeah. Compton, right?
Logan Compton. Yep.
You have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 tracks on this record.
Mm-hmm.
It clocks in at about a half hour, mm-hmm. which again is it's sort of a throwback to the LP era, because you could only fit so much information on or sound on an album. You still can. And it was about 42 minutes, I think, or maybe 41 and some change. Most performers of that era tended to deliver albums that were roughly a half hour, maybe a little bit more, 30 to 35 minutes. Stephen Wilson, who is in Porcupine Tree, the progressive rock band, but also a solo artist, he has a podcast. Again, who doesn't have a podcast these days, right?
Right.
He was saying in an interview, again, for another podcast, that sometimes there's too much music on record releases, CDs, whether it's streaming, if an album is just a streamed only or digital only. He says it's just too much. Like 60 minutes of music or 63 minutes of music can just grate on the listener. At some point, fatigue builds in.
Right.
And sometimes less is more. And his current album, his solo one, The Future Bites, clocks in at under 40 minutes, because he said that's about the sweet spot for people when they listen to records. That's about right. You want to leave them sort of hungry for more. And I think that you've kind of done this on your record. The last track on here is called Snowplow Man, which is, I like it. It's very bluesy, but you did something with your voice. Maybe that's a studio effect, but your voice sounds very different from Joyride. You're affecting a sound, and maybe you got that in the studio, but I'm sure in the demo, you in your head, and when you're writing the song, you wanted to have this kind of voice. So let's play a little bit of Snowplow Man.
Yeah.
See what I'm saying? It's like your voice is different there. So a little bit, but talk about that song. How did that one come about?
Sure. So Snowplow Man is something, you don't get to release Snowplow Man as a single or on an EP, but an album. Yeah, you can release that as number 8 on the album. That's no problem. So that was kind of like our tongue in cheek, just kind of, we're not taking ourselves seriously. We've done that for a long time. Let's lighten up the mood here. But yeah, the vocal sound really neat. Definitely very different from Joyride. I would say how I sing that one, I'm like taking all the way down from my stomach and bringing the voice up from there just to get that raspy Delta Blues style or whatever, you know. But, you know, really those Delta Blues guys, they're probably just like scoffing at me right now for, you know, just, but it's all in good nature, all in good fun. But yeah, Snowplow Man, it was fun. And then to get that really cool vocal sound, we actually ran it through a Leslie rotary speaker, which is like an old, like a speaker they'd use for like a Hammond organ, just to kind of throw the sound around to get that kind of vibrato stereo chorus effect. It just added so much to the song. It just kind of made the vocals kind of swell around, and definitely a really fun song to record. I think the vocals were done in one take. The guitar was definitely done in one take. Like, it was just like, hey, that's good. It's done. Like, we don't need to like fuss with that anymore. It was one of those things where we just kind of just said, hey, yeah, that's good. I think that's awesome. Let's not, you know, the more we mess with it, the worse we're going to make it. That was like a 20-minute song. It was really quick.
Those are sometimes the fun ones to do, right?
Yeah.
Because it's just sort of like, we don't need to do any more with this. This is great. This is great. Let's move on to the next track. Speaking of the record and certainly the single, how did you get your album on, or at least the single on radio stations around the country? Because in your press release, you've got a couple of Pennsylvania stations, classic rock stations, that are playing Joyride. And people that are longtime listeners to this podcast know I work for iHeartMedia. One of the stations that you got Joyride on is an iHeart station. From my perspective, and I'm a news guy, traffic guy, so I don't work in the music programming side. But my understanding with the radio industry nowadays, many of the companies, and there's really only a handful of companies that own the vast majority of real estate radio properties out there, is that they tend to standardize their playlists. They're kind of nationalize their playlists. Like, you could go from one end to the other of the country and you turn in the radio station. And if it's a rock station, you're probably going to hear the same songs, whether you're in San Francisco or whether you're in Nashville. The classic rock station will probably play the same lineup of songs and artists. So how difficult was it to get your song on the radio?
This actually came pretty easy. In addition to, you know, the 102.5 WDVE, I mean, we grew up with that radio station, Isaac, myself, and Johnny. That's just the classic rock station in Pittsburgh we all have grown to love. I mean, our dads listened to that when they were our age, and, you know.
And they're probably still listening to it, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. We always joke, they've been playing the same stuff for the past 30 years, but that's okay. It's good stuff. But no, we love them. I mean, they're just so great with the community and everything, too. Just all the DJs there. And we got picked up by some Nashville radio stations too, since I sent out that initial press release, which has been really, really helpful, actually, just because obviously we're based in Nashville now. But what it comes down to getting on the radio stations was that, you know, we've been an independent band for the better part of the past 5 years, and we've been a band for the past, you know, 10 years. And all that grind of playing all sorts of showcases and clubs in the area, we got to meet a lot of the radio DJs personally, whether it was Pittsburgh or somewhere else, and just building those relationships. And you know, whenever we do have a release out, these radio DJs, they're excited for it. And we genuinely are excited to hear our song played on the radio. So that's what it comes down to. We don't pay money to obviously have our song on the radio. It's just just very grassroots marketing campaign of, we just put our CDs in envelopes with a nice little press release, some stickers, and just say, hey, here it is. Play it. If you like it, great. If not, no worries. You know, we're just happy to have been just very blessed to have been able to make a record, I think. But I want to thank all the DJs that have been playing our songs. They've just been so helpful to our career, really, just with having our stuff played on the radio. And just, I think of that that movie with Tom Hanks, That Thing You Do.
Yeah.
In the movie, when they've heard their song, the first time they ever heard the song on the radio, they all were kind of like jumping like crazy up and down, and like the dads. I mean, I remember the first time I heard a song on the radio in Pittsburgh, and we were like that. And even today, I still get so excited, whether it's 7:30 in the morning and I'm driving to work or whatever. Like, you know, it just really makes me so happy to hear it on the radio. It's just like, it always sounds better on the radio.
There's something magical about hearing a song on the radio. Yes, you can essentially simulate the same thing by streaming it. It's coming through your car speakers, But there's just something about the fact that your music is being played alongside of maybe bands that you really admire or you're just super fans of. And you're like, oh my God, they just came out of AC/DC or something like that. And then they play Joyride and then they went into a Zeppelin song.
We're right exactly. there. Yeah, it's amazing.
So you're kind of the guy doing the back end or at least the business end of things. So you're picking which song is going to be the one that you want as a single. So obviously Joyride was the first single. Is there a follow-up?
Yeah, so we released Play That Rock and Roll, the title track, as the follow-up single about a month before we released the record. And that one actually garnered a little bit of radio play, too. I would say at this point, it's probably 50-50. Certain radio stations, stylistically, they're more like the Americana style. We've actually had some Americana stations pick up the Play That Rock and Roll tune, which is kind of cool. Like, I mean, definitely it has like that, like kind of like Skinner vibe. I would think more British blues, but Leonard Skinner, that is, but it definitely has more of the Southern rock kind of sound. And I mean, that's kind of what we are going for with the record. I mean, we're a bunch of Yankees. We moved to the South.
Right.
There is something special about those mid-70s Southern rock records that they definitely had a sound.
Well, let's play a little bit of the title track here.
Awesome.
Play That Rock and Roll, the title track from the new album from the Semi Super Villains out of Nashville, Tennessee, but originally from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, or at least the area, Pittsburgh area. Vinny Longhi, he is the lead singer, the songwriter, and the speaking voice of the band Semi Super Villains. Vinny, thank you so much for visiting Planet LP.
Thanks, Ted. Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
And that's it for another week. Thank you so much for listening. I'll be back soon to drop the needle on a world of albums. So long.